Okay, we have 15, 20 minutes, I think, to have a little discussion following on from this session. But I'd like to, first of all, introduce a new member to the group, and that's Bradford Mills. And Bradford is the Chief Executive Officer at Mandalay Resources, and an extensive history of directorships in mining operations, actually, such as Norilsk and things like this. So, Bradford is involved in capital investment and raising funding to put into mining operations, essentially. So I'm going to ask him to start off with, actually, to sort of in a couple of minutes to summarize what he thinks of this session, and in particular what he thinks of the how, if you want, environmental sensibilities are affecting the investment market. Put it that way, okay?
Great, thanks. So I'm a bit of an accidental tourist in this very august scientific realm. And I'm here primarily because I was the first student of this man at Stanford University a long time ago, and I won't go into how long ago, but it was a long time ago. But I'm also here as a practitioner, somebody who actually invests and builds mines around the world, who has discovered some of the largest deposits and has dealt with, as an operator, large-scale environmental issues in terms of management, the geopolitics of investment. And in talking to Gordon and to Mike over dinner the last couple of nights, they asked me really to talk about what I think is a fundamental moral dilemma that often escapes people in the dealing in the micro, in the nanoparticles, or dealing in the macro space. That's important to consider when you think about anything related to mining, natural resources, humans, the planet, and the biosphere. And the dilemma is fundamentally something like this, is that before a mineral deposit is discovered, wherever it happens to be in the world, generally that mountain stream field is of little or no value, or is being used in, you know, it could be just raw jungle, it could be desert. It's considered of no value by the national government, by the locals, and some entrepreneurial geologist or some company geologist wanders over, stumbles over something of interest, and eventually discovers this incredibly valuable ore deposit, at which point the problems really get serious. And there's been a lot of debate about things like the resource curse. You know, finding gold in Ghana is a bad thing because then you have all the problems of pollution and inequality related by the job creation and all of those sorts of things. But what is apparent, if you look at the macro and look at the long-term history of mineral development, is the real outcome in terms of the value that's created and how that value ultimately flows to society is very dependent on the decisions that the individual people make that are associated with that. In fact, the mineral deposit itself is completely agnostic as to whether good or bad comes out of it on a long or short-term basis. And if we look at the California Gold Rush, the outcome of the California Gold Rush in a long-term sense is the Great Society of California today, Stanford University, Silicon Valley, everything that San Francisco is, which was funded from the original Gold Rush, the rebuilding of San Francisco after the earthquake in 06 was funded by the gold fields in Nevada, at Gold Fields Nevada specifically. And so the long-term outcome was very different than some of the legacy issues that you actually look at. And so kind of depends on your societal and long-term social framework when you look at outcomes. Similar story in South Africa, the development of the gold mines in South Africa, very different outcome. Most of the wealth was exported out of South Africa, went into building London and funding two world wars in Europe, and produced apartheid civilization in South Africa and the maybe less than entirely successful city of Johannesburg today with Soweto and extreme poverty. Same basic natural endowment, roughly the same amount of gold produced, very, very different outcomes. Nothing to do with the ore deposits, the geology, it's all to do with the people and the decision-making surrounding that. So there was a question earlier today about the legal framework and what's emerged, of course, is over time, greater appreciation of the need for having a regulator who is separate from the investor, and that interaction between the regulator assessing the actions and the plans of the investor in terms of the long-term outcome, trying to mitigate or reduce the cost to society. However, that gets very, very clouded very, very quickly in another problem, which is, again, how to share the wealth. Norway's a good example. Sovereign wealth fund, billions of dollars. Everybody in Norway is very happy. All the oil money going into the sovereign wealth fund. Until, let's say, we have a major oil disaster off the Norwegian coast with a major, huge oil spill, and the attendancy is going to want to be to blame Shell or BP or Exxon or Norsk Hydro or whoever does it. But who got all the value from the exploitation of that oil field? Oh, the sovereign wealth fund of Norway. Should they not then have to contribute to the cleanup because they took all the money after all? So there are intrinsically entangled moral dilemmas that need to be rethought, I think, at a more fundamental level when we consider things like, gee, Scotland wants to have a sovereign wealth fund for all the oil in the North Sea. That's great, but then they get to do all the legacy cleanup issues when they're over, and maybe that sovereign wealth fund gets spent on legacy environmental repair, so maybe it's not quite as large a fund as they hoped. So there are a lot of dilemmas about how that pie gets split, and how do you then also encourage the entrepreneurialism and the responsible development of natural resources, by hopefully people like myself, considering myself responsible, we'll come back to that, versus pure exploitation. The going in and doing things at minimum cost with maximum environmental damage, with minimum consideration to long-term social consequences, for instance, to make sure that China gets all of the copper it needs out of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and who cares what happens to the rivers in Democratic Congo 100 years from now, where the wealth gets fundamentally transferred and exported somewhere else. So the whole issues, or all the issues surrounding the development of natural resources and their uses, I think need to be thought of from this more complex framework about how that wealth is shared and how it plays out over long-term kind of history. Now the other part of it is if you get too much goo on top of the entrepreneurial elements of this, then nothing gets done, because at the bottom of all of this is guys like me who have to raise capital, have to invest it, have to meet obligations for shareholders, have to pay the employees, pay the taxes, et cetera. And there has to be enough incentive to do that. And one of the dilemmas in the world today is the very varied incentivization that occurs around the globe between sort of sophisticated regimes in the US and in Mexico versus very aggressive, very unfriendly regimes in places like Zimbabwe or other countries where there's really no incentive for most investors to invest unless they have different kinds of criteria than normal economics. So that's really, I think, my job today is to throw all this stuff out there. Two words on Plinian Capital and Mandalay, just so you get a little bit of context, and I'll stop. We formed the business in 2009. There were four of us that formed it in the post-global financial crisis. Today, we have over 1,000 employees. All of those were new jobs created from scratch in Australia, Chile, and Sweden. We pay about $40 million in dividends to investors in that same period, a little over $40 million in taxes to the various national governments. And so certainly has a social and economic value to all the people around us in the exploitation development of mines in the world. So thanks, I'll stop.
Yeah, I think you've raised a number of interesting points. So let's open it to the panel. To make a comment sort of around that sort of, on that side, the social conscience side of things and investment side of things, and then we'll open it to the audience. So, okay, Mike, yeah.
I'd like to ask Brad a question. He's saying, you already asked me about 40 questions, do I really need another one? But just what you said there at the end, that the value of your company employing hundreds, thousands of people, making tens of millions of dollars for investors, but as an earth scientist, and obviously clearly environmentally responsible earth scientist, how have you been able to somehow keep control of this dilemma to make sure, I'm not talking about before 2009, I'm just talking about the last 6 years, how you have personally and your partners have been able to keep control of this dilemma, keeping profitability advantage of resource generation from going outside of where it's produced, and also in terms of environmental cleanliness as these systems are developed economically. How have you been able to handle that personally in your company?
Sure. So great question. So the first thing is we're what's called a value-based organization. We have a set of core values that we adhere to. And one of those is around environment is to do no permanent environmental damage. And the word permanent is important because obviously when you're digging a mine, you are disturbing the surface, you are disturbing land as you build the tailings and the dumps and so on. But the long-term goal is that when they're fully restored and you're finished, that the land use that is then available is identical to what it was when you started, and that there is no permanent damage. And a lot of it obviously comes in very good understanding of the science in terms of what do we have acid rate waste rock generation, and if so, how do we manage and contain it? All of our sites are what are called zero discharge sites, which is that nothing is allowed to leave the site in terms of water or dust or other effluents. And so a lot of control goes into managing all of those. I'm not going to argue that we're perfect, but we're pretty good. And we've had no significant issues in any of our operations around the world. Not that we can't make mistakes, but the objective and the goal is to design the system so that the risk is reduced to as low as you can feasibly do it economically.
Any other comments from the panel?
Emphasize that a lot of the pollution that we deal with on this planet is not necessarily man-made, but it's natural. An example of that is the Cricetil asbestos mine that I showed you, the KCAC mine, King City Asbestos Company mine, is the second largest mine in North America for Cricetil, the largest being at Thetford, Quebec. And I just want to emphasize that that material, that big massif that was intruded, basically, because it's a lower density rock than the other crustal rocks around it, has been exposed at the Earth's surface for over 20 million years. And it's been shedding asbestos fibers for over 20 million years, long before humans ever got involved in mining it. You can find particles of asbestos in ice cores in Greenland that predate the Industrial Revolution, which tells us that this stuff was being circulated around the globe from point sources like that particular mine that was exposed, again, not by humans, but by nature. So a lot of the things that we worry about in terms of pollution are not necessarily man-made. Now, man does mine stuff, crush it, increase surface area, which increases reactivity, and probably the human health impact as well. But a lot of the material is simply natural.
Okay.
Perhaps I have a question as well. In many countries, we find now that the mining production is predestined to reach China. In other words, most of the mining production in this world is going to China. And they also prefer to export back finished goods. So in other words, it seems like there is a destruction of knowledge through the production of primary materials going to China and no development of primary expertise to treat ores, to treat remediate. There seems to be a reduction of knowledge due to the predominance of I'm not blaming China, I'm just saying, but due to the predominance of Chinese production. And I think this is also probably a consequence in the garments industry, shoemaking industry. What is left in Western countries nowadays? So to me, that seems to be a danger. What is your comment on that?
Well, it's a complicated issue. We look at some of these kind of macro issues pretty thoroughly. But I'll just throw a few statistics out there, and I'm not going to validate them, so don't hold me to them completely. But the second fastest growing part of the world after China is sub-Saharan Africa, which is a 6.5% to 7% growth rate over the last 10 years. So it is also economically growing dramatically. Maybe not so much in the downstream processing world of steelmaking or heavy manufacturing, but certainly in terms of very rapid development of agriculture, very rapid development of light manufacturing, so a lot of other things that are going on in sub-Saharan Africa that are different, perhaps, than the major industrial revolution that is going on in China. And China, it's important to understand, it is a major industrial revolution. This is a country that's you know, really fast climbing up that industrial curve, similar to what happened in the U.S. and Europe post World War II in the 50s and 60s. And that is a world changing event given the scale of 1.2 billion people moving from subsistence poverty into lower middle class. And there was a comment earlier about the metal intensity or the resource intensity of civilization. And there's a tipping point that happens when a civilization crosses $4,000 per capita GDP, where it goes from sort of, you know, relatively low metal intensity resource usage to something like 5x. It's like almost an order of magnitude change. And it's fairly easy to understand. If you go to China, you would see this, is that you have people coming off of farms where they live in, you know, small houses and almost huts, and then they move into a standard block housing with electrification. They go and buy single room air conditioners and a motorbike. Their metal intensity goes from zero to, you know, a significant amount as an individual on a per capita per year basis. And that's what's driving this huge consumption of natural resources and flow into China. The issue, and the more complicated issue, of sort of the 10 years or 15 years of, you know, a dollar an hour wage for virtually everything, and the hollowing out of textile industries and the re-exportation out of China, is a somewhat more complicated issue, and I think it touches what you're talking about. The U.S., similar dilemma. It produces 10,000 electrical engineers a year to fuel the likes of Silicon Valley. And Chinese universities produce 140,000 electrical engineers annually. And it doesn't take a lot of imagination to figure out where ultimately the innovation in electronics is going to go. And you can multiply that times a lot of other fields, that China is going to become a major world powerhouse as it climbs up this industrial revolution curve, just simply because of scale. And if you have that many brains who are looking at these many problems, they're going to come up with new and different solutions. I think it's a big phenomenon of globalization. And the most important thing is connect it all together quickly, make sure it stays in communication, and let's not blow it up. That's probably my advice for my generation.
And I'll add to what Brad said. I've had a number of Chinese scientists, everything from master's students to professors in my labs over the years. And I've been to China a number of times. And I've asked them, and in fact, I've sat in Beijing or in Guangzhou, and I've sat next to a Communist Party chief, and I've said, how do you do this? You're growing so fast. This is so wonderful. It's an amazing process you have going on in this country. And he says, no. We have 1.3, not quite, 1.3 minus X, where X is very small. People in poverty, as Brad said, we're trying to move them up into lower middle class. It's going to take decades to do that with that many people. So we have to have dramatic industry, dramatically inefficient and polluting industries. At the same time, and this is the irony of the situation, they are very concerned with polluting not only their country, but the planet. There's no problem in China, whether you're a communist official or someone in deep poverty, to understand that climate change is very dangerous. Unlike, unfortunately, my country, where more than half the population doesn't really care or doesn't even, quote, believe in climate change. Not to mention the politics in our country, which have gone to very dangerous levels of not trusting science. They don't have that problem in China. So on the one hand, they're being one of the world's, obviously, along with the United States, the greatest polluters. But on the other side of the story is they're very concerned about it. So they're funding environmental science to extraordinary degrees, massive amounts of money going into environmental science research and solutions to the environmental problems that they know they've created. Trying to move, again, 1.2 billion people from dire poverty up into something that would be considered at least subsistence living. And I've been through the countryside of China, and I just can't believe how poor and destitute people are. And now, as Brad implied, there's a massive movement into the cities. They are building literally hundreds of high-rises per week around the country. So you go to a small city, which is only maybe 5 million people in China, or 1 million people in a city in China is considered small. And even in their small cities, you'll see dozens of new high rises every month as people move from the countrysides into the manufacturing sectors to try to bring the standard of living up. And the pollution is unbelievable and unbelievably dangerous, yet they are trying to mitigate at the same time as quickly as possible.